Welcome to the Book Report. It's a new year with a new crop of mysteries vying for your time and consideration. I'm your host, Elaine Charles, and I'm thrilled to bring mystery thriller fans interviews with two authors at the top of their game. Plus, the books we'll preview this week are a mix of new titles from favorite authors and series that may be new to you. It's all ahead in a show full of mystery and mayhem as we turn to page one of the Book Report. Been dreaming of a new kitchen? One right for the way you cook, for optimizing your space and your unique style? Lifestyles Kitchens has a menu of options that work within your budget. Lifestyles Kitchens is one of New England's top design studios. Our professional designers come to your home, assess your space, cooking style, and guide you through a wide world of choices. Then we'll design the perfect kitchen or bath with you. Start with cabinets from Woodmode, Brookhaven, Candlelight, DBS, or Neff. Add exquisite counters of granite, engineered stone, and more, and finish with fabulous fixtures. Your dream kitchen doesn't come out of a box or a big box store. And for a truly memorable gift for those special to you, consider Lifestyles Kitchens gift certificates. Contact us today at lifestyleskitchens.com. That's two S's, lifestyleskitchens.com. The Last Man by Vince Flynn is book number 13 in the incredibly popular Mitch Rapp series. This title finds Rapp in Afghanistan, investigating the disappearance of Joe Rickman, the man responsible for the CIA's clandestine operations in Afghanistan. He's also the guy who's worked with virtually every disreputable figure in the country. More than $250 million has passed through Rickman's hands during his tenure as master of black ops, and no one with a shred of sense wants to know the details of how that money had been spent. At first glance, it seems that Rickman had been kidnapped, but Rapp is not so sure. The CIA director orders Rapp to find Rickman at all costs. To do so, Rapp must navigate the ever-shifting landscape of Afghanistan as the Taliban, Iranians, Pakistanis, and Russians all plot to claim their piece of the war-torn state. George Guidel narrates.
The four dead men were lined up on the living room floor of the safe house. Mitch Rapp started with the one on the left. The bearded face, the dark, lifeless eyes, and the dime-sized bullet hole that marked the center of the man's forehead were all expected. One bullet, nice and neat, the way Rapp would have done it. The next two bodyguards looked the same, including red pucker marks in the center of their brows. The fourth Afghani was a different story. He'd been shot through the back of the head. A quarter of his face was now a jagged crater of flesh, blood, and bone. The exit wound told him the man had been shot by something a lot bigger than a 9mm, probably a .45 caliber with ammunition that pancaked and tumbled for maximum damage. There was nothing about this mess to give Rapp any assurance that things would be fine, but this last little twist cracked open the door on something he didn't want to consider. Rapp set the troubling thought aside for a second, tried to imagine how it had gone down. The early signs pointed toward a well-coordinated assault. The perimeter security had been breached. Phone line cameras, motion sensors, heat sensors, and even the pressure pads had all been taken offline. The backup connection through the satellite dish on the roof had also been disabled. Whoever had attacked the safe house had the knowledge and skill to hit the place without setting off a single alarm and alerting the quick reaction force less than a mile away at the airbase. According to the experts at Langley, this was never supposed to happen. 4 years earlier, they had claimed the safe house was impregnable against any threat that the Taliban or any other local group could come up with. Rapp had told those same experts that they were full of... He'd never seen an impregnable safe house for the simple reason that people had to come and go. As with most CIA safe houses, this one was intentionally bland. There was no American flag flown out front, and there were no snappy Marines standing post at the main gate. This was a black site where the more unpleasant aspects of the war had been coordinated. Langley didn't want any official records of the comings and goings of the drug dealers, warlords, arms dealers, local politicians, police, and Afghan army officers who were on the take. The house looked like your run-of-the-mill, two-story blockhouse in Jalalabad. There were quite a few upgrades that made it unique, but from the outside, it looked dingy and run down, just like all the other houses in the neighborhood. The cinder block wall that surrounded the property was coated with a special resin designed to prevent it from exploding into a million pieces and shredding the house in the event of a car bomb. The simple-looking front door contained a 1-inch steel plate and a reinforced steel frame. All of the windows were bulletproof plexiglass, and the high-tech security cameras and sensors were concealed so as not to attract the attention of the neighbors. Langley had even taken the unusual precaution of buying the houses on each side and moving in the bodyguards and their families, all to protect one man. Joe Rickman was the most cunning and brilliant operative Rapp had ever worked with. They'd known each other for 16 years. At first, Rapp didn't know what to think of him. Rickman was pure vanilla. There wasn't a single physical characteristic about him that was memorable. At 5'10", he was neither tall nor short. His mousy brown hair matched his dull brown eyes, and his weak chin completed the bland lines of his roundish face. On the rare occasion that you heard him speak, he was never animated, and his voice was pure monotone, the kind of thing that could put the most restless baby to sleep. Rickman's forgettable face allowed him to blend in, and those who met him were almost underwhelmed by his presence. For Rickman, that was just fine. Much of his success was built on fools underestimating him. He'd worked for the CIA for 23 years, and it was rumored that he had never set foot inside headquarters. Only a few months earlier, Rapp had asked him if the rumor was true. Rickman responded with a soft smile and said that he'd never been invited.
We've just heard The Last Man by Vince Flynn. Lee Child, a wildly popular author of the Jack Reacher series, was born in 1954 in Coventry, England. He spent his formative years in nearby Birmingham. After law school and part-time work in the theater, Lee joined Granada Television in Manchester. He worked there for 18 years, contributing to such hits as Brideshead Revisited and The Jewel in the Crown. Lee was fired in 1995 at the age of 40, a result of corporate restructuring. Always a voracious reader, he did some mid-career redirection and wrote his first book, The Killing Floor, the first in the Jack Reacher series. The rest is literary history. Child has written 17 Reacher books, which have sold 40 million copies worldwide. The latest Reacher installment is A Wanted Man, and of course there's the new movie, actually based on book 9 of the series. Lee now lives in Manhattan and in the south of France. Welcome, Lee. We're thrilled to have you as our guest on the Book Report.
Thank you. It's great to be there.
First, Lee Child is a pen name of yours. Is it an homage to a beloved literary character or a person in your life?
No, it was just a sort of family joke, ultimately. It was a sort of catchphrase we had for various things in our little family, and so I decided to use it.
And how did you select the name Reacher? Is it because he was always striving to right wrongs?
Well, that's kind of what people think, but it's a lot more prosaic than that, actually. I was struggling for a name, and I was out at the grocery store one day with my wife, and I'm a tall guy, and every time I go to the store, a little old lady asks me to reach her a can from a high shelf. And my wife said, you know what, if the book doesn't work out, you could be a reacher in a supermarket. I thought, wow, that's a pretty good name.
Wow, that's unexpected. Now, the movie Jack Reacher is based on book 9 in the series. How did you and the filmmakers decide upon that story?
Well, it was the beginning of that story that really swayed them, because that story is different than some of the others in that Reacher does not show up immediately on page 1. I think in the book it's maybe 40 pages before he shows up, and the other characters have been searching for him. So we've had time for him to be introduced and explained and described by other people, so that by the time he does show up, we're ready for the story to start. And so they liked that structure. They thought it was a good kind of mythic beginning for the character, and it got all the the who is this guy stuff out of the way before he shows up, and then we can get straight into the action. So it was just that decision, and the rest of the book holds up really well. You know, it's a good, solid plot and plenty of action and incident and good characters and so on. And so I backed the choice completely. I thought it was a great place to start.
Were you involved in the film at all?
Yeah, I was very involved, not on any kind of official level, because I believe that nothing can be done by committee. I didn't want them thinking I was watching over their shoulder, and I didn't want them to be worrying about my reaction. So at the beginning, I just said, guys, this is your movie, you do it, don't worry about me. And that, I think, liberated them. It made them relax, and so we got this great product. But along the way, they're friendly, they're generous, they're inclusive people. We had a lot of fun. They would invite me down there. I would hang out with them a lot, and I saw a lot of it being done. And it was a great experience, a lot of fun, and a sort of different kind of year for me from normal.
And I understand you have a cameo in the film.
Yeah, you know, that was the sort of way they think. They wanted me to be part of it, and there was this role that is a tiny little thing, you know, blink and you'll miss me, but it was symbolic in their eyes in terms of the story. It was almost like me passing the torch to Tom Cruise for the duration of the movie, and they wanted me to do it, and I was very happy to comply.
Sadly, were you involved with the decision to delay the premiere in deference to the tragedy at Sandy Hook?
Yeah, well, you know, that it was just a completely human decision. I don't think there was anything, you know, corporate thinking about it. We all just felt nobody wants to go and party today, you know. We just didn't feel like it. And if we had gone and forced ourselves, then I don't think anybody would have shown up anyway, because nobody really felt in the mood for it that day. So it was purely just a human reaction, and I think it was the right one.
All right. Those of us devoted to your books know that Reacher is 6'5" and 220 pounds, which doesn't exactly describe Tom Cruise. How did you react when you knew he was going to be cast in the role?
Well, you know, no actor really is of those dimensions. You know, 6'5", 220, 230, whatever it is, there are no actors of that size. So I knew, you know, from the very beginning in principle that if we ever did have a movie, we were not going to get a physical reflection of Reacher, because that is not available. So then it became really important to have an actor good enough to get the inside of Reacher up on the screen, his quiet nature, his stoicism, his watchfulness, the strong silent aspect of Reacher. We needed somebody to get that vibe up on the screen, which was a challenge because it's not easy playing a kind of quiet guy. And so we wanted the best actor we could find. And to me, that is Tom Cruise. I mean, Tom Cruise is a movie star, of course, but that's only because he's a really good actor. Mm. And I wasn't interested in Tom Cruise, the movie star. I wanted Tom Cruise, the actor. And that's who showed up. And he worked incredibly hard. He worked incredibly intelligently. And in my opinion, he nails the role. And I think the people that see the movie will agree. You know, that is Reacher. He really pulled it off.
Well, okay, I have a girl question to ask. Why does Reacher seem incapable of a long-term relationship? Is there some core sadness that makes it impossible for him to find love?
I think there's a core sort of loneliness or a conflict all the time between he enjoys the solitude, but he's worried about being lonely. And, of course, the catch-22 for Reacher is that he likes smart women. And the smarter the woman, the more aware she is that this is just not going to work. You know, it's a great thing for a couple of days, but if you're smart enough, you see the future and you think, this is not a long-term guy. So it's not solely Reacher's decision. Unfortunately, you know, the women have a say in it too, and they are saying, you know, I can't see a future with this guy. And so, yeah, he's just condemned to wander by himself. And I think that does give him a kind of sadness.
Have you ever come to sit down with a new Reacher book and not have that kernel of an idea?
No, there's ideas everywhere, you know. It's exactly the opposite problem. It's not that it's difficult to get ideas. It's difficult to choose between the 100 ideas that would make a great book. And specifically, you know, a book's more than one idea. You need 2 or 3 ideas that kind of collide and combine. And so it's the selection of the ideas that's the difficult part.
With the reemergence of compelling TV dramas like The Sopranos and Homeland, do you ever see yourself getting back into TV?
Yeah, well, I you know, never say never, and I am right now actually with my daughter. We are writing a TV pilot for somebody, and I'm really enjoying that, partly because it's a different discipline and also partly because working with my daughter is a lot of fun.
Hmm. And are you involved with the production of the audiobooks? For example, do you give Dick Hill directions?
Well, Dick's a friend of mine by now. You know, we've been doing this together, all 17 books, and he gets the book and he always emails me with his opinion, and if he's got any questions, he will ask them, you know, typically about pronunciation of words and so on. But again, just like with the movie, I believe in if you've got a great person, just let them do the job. Don't watch over their shoulder.
Hmm. Tell us a little about the newest Reacher title, A Wanted Man.
Yeah, that came out in September, and that is a pure what-if book. Reacher was in the middle of nowhere. It was midnight in Nebraska in the winter, so he was trying to hitchhike east, and he gets into a car. And then I thought, well, what if the people in the car, what if there's something wrong with them? And so within about 30 minutes, Reacher realizes that they're all lying to him. They are not who they say they are. And he's locked into this car doing 80 miles an hour on the interstate. What is he going to do about it? And then there's a police roadblock up ahead. You know, things just get worse and worse, and that's how I write, and that's how the story unfolds.
You know, a lot of the Reacher locations are in very remote, desolate locales. Do you visit the settings for the books?
I do. I mean, I do it in kind of reverse order. I will have been there for some other reason, or no reason at all, just hanging out. And then if it makes a good impression on me in terms of interesting landscape and secrets and so on, then it will occur, crop up in a book in the future. You know, as a European person, that's one of the things that just fascinates me about this continent. It's so gigantic, and it's so, in parts, it's so crowded, and in parts, it's so empty. Some places you can drive for hours and never see another person. Some days, here in New York, you can't walk a yard without bumping into another person. The variety is endless.
Are there already conversations for the next movie?
Well, but, you know, very anxious to see how this one does. Everything is, they don't want to jinx it by talking about future installments, but it's clear that if this one works, then there would be a sequel, and it would make sense, in my opinion, if Jack Reacher as a movie is very urban. It was shot in Pittsburgh. It has an urban, gritty feel, so logically the next one maybe should be one of those remote, empty, desolate movies, and there are several books that they could choose from.
It's a real thrill to speak with you. I'm a Reacher fanatic, as millions are, so thanks so much for joining us today.
Absolutely, my pleasure. Thank you.
Alrighty, bye.
Bye-bye.
And now, let's hear a sampling of One Shot, Book 9 in the Reacher series, performed by Dick Hill.
The garage was always packed. He knew that. That was why they were extending it. They were doubling its size. It was used by shoppers. That was why it was quiet. Nobody in their right mind would try to leave at 5 o'clock. Not into the rush hour traffic. Not with the construction delays. Either they would get out by 4 or wait until 6. The man in the minivan checked his watch. 4 minutes. Easy. He opened the driver's door and slid out, took a quarter from his pocket and put it in the meter, twisted the handle hard, and heard the coin fall and saw the clockwork give him an hour in exchange. There was no other sound, nothing in the air except the smell of parked automobiles, gasoline, rubber, cold exhaust. He stood still next to the van. On his feet, he had a pair of old desert boots, khaki suede, single eyelets, white crepe soles, made by Clarks of England, much favored by Special Forces soldiers, an iconic design, unchanged in maybe 60 years. He glanced back at the parking meter. 59 minutes. He wouldn't need 59 minutes. He opened the minivan's sliding rear door and leaned inside and unfolded a blanket and revealed the rifle. It was a Springfield M1A Supermatch autoloader, American walnut stock, heavy premium barrel, 10-shot box magazine, chambered for the .308. It was the exact commercial equivalent of the M14 self-loading sniper rifle that the American military had used during his long-ago years in the service. It was a fine weapon. Maybe not quite as accurate with the first cold shot as a top-of-the-line bolt gun, but it would do. It would do just fine. He wasn't going to be looking at extraordinary distances. It was loaded with Lake City M852s, his favorite custom cartridges. Special Lake City Match Brass, Federal Powder, Sierra Match King 168 grain hollow point boat tail bullets. The load was better than the gun, probably. A slight mismatch. He listened to the silence and lifted the rifle off the rear bench, carried it away with him to where the old part of the garage finished and the new part began. There was a half-inch trench between the old concrete and the new, like a demarcation line. He guessed it was an expansion joint for the summer heat. He guessed they were going to fill it with soft tar. Directly above it, there was yellow and black "Caution, Do Not Enter" tape strung between two pillars. He dropped to one knee and slid under it, stood up again and walked on into the raw, new construction. Parts of the new concrete floor were troweled smooth, and parts were rough, still waiting for a final surface. There were wooden planks laid here and there as walkways. There were haphazard piles of paper cement sacks, some full, some empty. There were more open expansion joints. There were strings of bare light bulbs, turned off. Empty wheelbarrows, crushed soda cans, spools of cable, unexplained lengths of lumber, piles of crushed stone, silent concrete mixers. There was gray cement dust everywhere, as fine as talc, and the smell of damp lime. The man with the rifle walked on in the darkness until he came close to the new northeast corner. Then he stopped and put his back tight against a raw concrete pillar and stood still, inched to his right, with his head turned until he could see where he was. He was about 8 feet from the garage's new perimeter wall, looking due north. The wall was about waist high. It was unfinished. It had bolts cast into it to take lengths of metal barrier to stop cars hitting the concrete. There were receptacles cast into the floor to take the new parking meter posts. The man with the rifle inched forward and turned a little until he felt the corner of the pillar between his shoulder blades. He turned his head again. Now he was looking north and east, directly into the public plaza. The ornamental pool was a long, narrow rectangle running away from him. It was maybe 80 feet by 20. It was like a large tank of water, just sitting there.
That was One Shot by Lee Child. Douglas Preston and Lincoln Child are a fabulous duo, highly skilled at keeping you turning those pages. Two Graves is book 12 of the popular Pendergast series. After his wife is brazenly abducted before his eyes, Special Agent Pendergast pursues the kidnappers across the continent and into Mexico. But then things go terribly, tragically wrong. The kidnappers escape, and a shattered Pendergast returns to New York to shut out the world. But when a string of bizarre murders erupts across several Manhattan hotels, the NYPD asks Pendergast for help. Reluctant at first, he soon discovers that the killings are a message from his wife's kidnappers. Why? What can that mean? When the kidnappers strike again at those closest to Pendergast, the FBI agent, filled anew with vengeful fury, sets out to track down and destroy those responsible. His journey takes him deep into the forests of South America, where he ultimately finds himself face to face with an old evil that is stirring anew, with potentially world-altering consequences. René Auberginois narrates.
The man appeared so suddenly in the doorway of Madeline Teal's office cubicle that she literally jumped. He was a very strange-looking man, dressed in black, with a pale face, gray eyes, and he radiated a restlessness bordering on agitation. "My, you gave me a start," she said, pressing a hand to her ample bosom. "Can I help you?" "I've come for Dr. Heffler." Now that was a strange way of phrasing it. He did look more than a little like the Grim Reaper, but the man did have a mellifluous voice with a charming southern accent. She herself came from the Midwest, and the various New York accents still grated on her nerves. "Do you have an appointment?" she asked. "Dr. Heffler and I are old buddies." Old buddies? Somehow the way he said it didn't sound right. Nobody would use the word buddy to describe Dr. Wayne Heffler, who was a pretentious pseudo-upper-class condescending twit, as far as Teal was concerned. She had known plenty of Hefflers in her long career, but he was truly the worst, one of those types whose highest pleasure was found in reviewing the work of subordinates with the sole purpose of finding fault and pointing it out in front of as many people as possible. Meanwhile, he neglected his own work and left others to scramble to cover for him, knowing they would be blamed if something went wrong or fell through the cracks. "And your name, sir?"
"Special Agent Pendergast."
"Oh, as in FBI?"
A singularly disturbing smile spread over the face of the special agent as a marble hand slipped inside his suit coat and withdrew a wallet, opened it to display a shield and ID, then gently closed it and reinserted it into the folds of black wool. With a not displeasing sense of anticipation, Madeline Teal pressed the intercom button and picked up the phone.
Dr. Heffler, there's an FBI agent named Pendergast here to see you. No appointment. Says he knows you.
A short pause.
Pendergast, did you say?
Yes, doctor.
Send him in.
She hung up.
You may go in.
But the agent didn't move.
Dr. Heffler may come out.
Now this was different. She got back on the phone.
He wants you to come out?
You tell that son of a bitch that if he wants to see me, I'm here in my office. Otherwise, send him away.
She felt a gentle tug. Pendergast's arm had snaked up and was gently grasping the phone.
May I?
She released the phone.
No one could fault her for not opposing an FBI agent.
Dr. Heffler?
Agent Pendergast.
She couldn't hear the reply, but the cricket-like chittering that drifted from the earpiece indicated a raised voice. Heffler was arguing.
This, thought Madeline Teal, is going to be good.
The FBI agent listened patiently, then responded,
I have come for the mitochondrial DNA results on the hotel killer.
More irritated chittering out of the mouthpiece.
What a shame.
He turned and smiled at her, an apparently genuine smile this time, as he handed her back the telephone.
Thank you. Now, which way is the laboratory where the mitochondrial DNA work is performed?
It's down the hall to the right, but...
No one's allowed in there unescorted, she said, lowering her voice.
Ah, but I won't be unescorted. Dr. Heffler will be escorting me, or at least he will be shortly.
But...
Pendergast, however, had his cell phone out and was making a call even as he walked out the door, turned right, and headed down the hall. Almost as soon as he'd vanished, Madeline Teal's phone rang and she picked it up.
Dr. Heffler, please, came the voice.
Mayor Stark.
Mayor Stark? Unbelievable. It really was him, calling personally.
Yes, sir, just a moment. She put the call through. It lasted less than 30 seconds. Then Heffler came bursting out of his office, face red.
Where'd he go?
Down the hall, to the lab. I told him. But Heffler had already taken off down the hall at an undignified jog. She had never seen the man so put out, so frightened, and, she had to be honest with herself, she enjoyed it immensely.
That was Two Graves by Douglas Preston and Lincoln Child. If thrillers are your genre, The Book Report would like to introduce you to Ian Rankin's Inspector Rebus. According to longtime Rebus fans, a good title to start with is The Naming of the Dead. This story is set in July 2005, when the G8 leaders have gathered in Scotland. With daily marches, demonstrations, and scuffles, the police have their hands full. Detective Inspector John Rebus has been sidelined until the apparent suicide of an MP coincides with clues that a serial killer may be on the loose. The authorities are keen to hush up both for fear of overshadowing a meeting of global importance. But Inspector Rebus has never been one to stick to the rules, and that's why readers keep coming back for more. Tom Kotcher performs the work.
Looking along the pew, Rebus saw the usher make a gesture. Everyone rose to their feet. Chrissy started walking up the aisle, flanked by her children. The usher looked to Rebus, but he stayed where he was. sat down again so the others would know they didn't have to wait for him. The song was only a little over halfway through. It was the closing track on Quadrophenia. Michael had been the Big Who fan, Rebus himself preferring the Stones. Had to admit, though, albums like Tommy and Quadrophenia did things the Stones never could. Daltrey was whooping that he could use a drink. Rebus had to agree. But there was a drive back to Edinburgh to consider. The function room of a local hotel had been booked. All were welcome, as the minister had reminded them from the pulpit. Whiskey and tea would be poured, sandwiches served. There would be anecdotes and reminiscences, smiles, dabs at the eyes, hushed tones. The staff would move quietly, out of respect. Rebus was trying to form sentences in his head, words which would act as his apology. I need to get back, Chrissy. The pressure of work. He could lie and blame the G8. That morning in the house, Leslie had said he must be busy with the build-up. He could have told her. I'm the only cop they don't seem to need. Officers were being drafted in from all over. 1,500 were coming from London alone. Yet, Detective Inspector John Rebus seemed surplus to requirements. Someone had to man the ship. The very words DCI James McRae had used, with his acolyte smirking by his shoulder. DI Derek Starr reckoned himself the heir apparent to McRae's throne. One day he'd be running Gayfield Square Police Station. John Rebus posed no threat whatsoever, not much more than a year away from retirement. Starr himself had said as much. Nobody'd blame you for coasting, John. It's what anyone your age would do. Maybe so. But the Stones were older than Rebus. Daltrey and Townsend were older than him too. Still playing, still touring. The song was ending now, and Rebus rose to his feet again. He was alone in the chapel. Took a final look at the purple velvet screen. Maybe the coffin was still behind it. Maybe it had already been moved to another part of the crematorium. He thought back to adolescence. Two brothers in their shared bedroom, playing 45s, bought down Kirkcaldy High Street. My Generation and Substitute. Mickey asking about Daltrey's stutter on the former. Rebus saying he'd read somewhere that it was to do with drugs. The only drug the brothers had indulged in was alcohol. Mouthfuls stolen from the bottles in the pantry. A can of sickly stout broken open and shared after lights out. Standing on Kirkcaldy Promenade, staring out to sea, and Mickey singing the words to I Can See for Miles. But could that really have happened? The record came out in 66 or 67, by which time Rebus was in the army. Must have been on a trip back. Yes, Mickey with his shoulder-length hair, trying to copy Daltrey's look, and Rebus with his forces crop, inventing stories to make army life seem exciting. Northern Ireland still ahead of him. They'd been close back then. Rebus always sending letters and postcards. His father proud of him. Proud of both the boys. The spit of your mum. He stepped outside. The cigarette packet was already open in his hand. There were other smokers around him. They offered nods, shuffling their feet. The various wreaths and cards had been lined up next to the door and were being studied by the mourners. The usual words would crop up. Condolence and loss and sorrow. The family would be in our thoughts. Michael wouldn't be mentioned by name. Death brought its own set of protocols. The younger mourners were checking for text messages on their phones. Rebus dug his own out of his pocket and switched it on. 5 missed calls, all from the same number. Rebus knew it from memory, pushed the buttons and raised the phone to his ear.
That was The Naming of the Dead by Ian Rankin. Jo Nesbø is a best-selling Norwegian author and musician. He was born in Oslo and graduated from the Norwegian School of Economics. Nesbo is famous around the world for his crime novels, but he's also famous as a singer and songwriter for the Norwegian rock band Didere, and as a children's writer. The Redbreast, book three of the series, had been voted Norway's greatest crime novel of all time by Norwegian Public Broadcasting. Phantom is the ninth Harry Hole novel, and we'll speak to Joe today about Harry, his genuine anti-hero, who, as described, was both the most competent detective of the Oslo police force and the worst civil servant. Welcome, Joe. It's such an honor to have you with us on the Book Report.
Well, thanks.
Harry Hole. I know. Emma, did I say it right?
Yeah.
Okay, but with your permission, I'm going to call him Harry Hole. When you wrote Harry in The Bat, the book one, did you know that he would be in so many of your novels?
I didn't even know it was going to get published because it was my first attempt at writing a novel. So I figured that, you know, it would get turned down by any publishing house. And hopefully I would get some letters saying that, we see some talent here. So please send us the next thing you're writing. So for me, it was just an attempt at writing a novel. So I thought that, you know, the easy way out is probably to write a crime novel. So I ended named Harry Hole, and to my surprise, it was published. But it probably wasn't until I started writing the third book that I knew I was going to have Harry around for a long time.
When you write a character, a recurring character, at your off moments, does he walk down the street in your head?
No, he doesn't. He's, he's a character of fiction, and I don't confuse reality and fiction. Of course, it is a universe that is very real to me. I mean, it is sort of a universe where I can go in and close the door, and then it's sort of a alternative reality to me. But up until now, I'm getting older, but up until now, I haven't confused the two worlds.
What interests you the most about Harry?
I think it's the fact that he's not a guy that you can rely on to make the right moral choices, and like any of us. And interesting to me as a writer, the interesting thing about the series is that I can give him these moral dilemmas. And I'm not even sure myself what choice he is going to make, even though I've known him now for 13 years. He still can be, he can have a good day and a bad day. In the end, though, I hope that he has made more right choices than wrong choices.
It seems like, you know, Harry tries to do the right thing, but yet it also seems like he's destined to lead an unhappy life.
Well, he does have his inner demons. I think that, you know, most interesting stories are crime stories, are not about whether the murderer is going to get caught or not, or who did it. Although that is important, of course, it's also about the eternal soul of the main character, as in any other story. It's, is his eternal soul going to heaven or hell? And that has to do with the moral choices he's making.
You wrote Follow the Hate. I've always read Follow the Money, or the French say Cherchez la Femme, but you wrote Follow the Hate. How does it figure in this book?
Well, I think to find the motive for murders, you have to look for extreme emotions. And I think that hate is the flip side of love. There was a famous Norwegian author who once said that the only things worth writing about is love and murder, and he was not a crime writer. So I think that hate is probably what you're looking for, or what you there's a sign that there's something going on when you can sense strong emotions in people, and that's one of Harry's gifts, that it can sense those emotions in people.
Okay, now I know you also write children's books featuring one amazing character, the eccentric Dr. Proctor, and the man who invented the world's most powerful fart powder, love him. Tell us about him.
Well, he was an invention that that came about one summer when my daughter, she would always ask me to tell her stories. And this particular summer, she asked me to tell a story. And she would always get to, you know, pick characters that would be in the stories. So she wanted a potato and a dinosaur. And a girl, pretty much like herself, and she was afraid of boys at the time, but she wanted the boy in the story, but he had to be smaller than the girl. And then I asked if we could have a mad professor in there, and she was okay with that. And then I asked her if we could have farting in the story, and she was not okay with that. And then I said, can we have a little farting in the story? And she said, okay, daddy. And so I started, you know, telling the story about Dr. Proctor and his two friends. They live in the same street, and he's this, you know, not very successful inventor. He has invented all kind of useless stuff, including a fart powder, which was actually meant to make people not fart in, you know, parties and funerals and stuff like that. So, but he got it wrong. So it's a strong farting powder. He can't sell it to anyone. Nobody has use for that. But then the little boy, he comes up with a marketing plan that you can sell this to all the kids before our 4th of July.
Back to your adult novel. You've said that Redbreast was actually the story your father wanted to tell. Tell us about that.
Well, it was in 1940. Norway was occupied by the Germans. And after that, you know, the young men in Norway, they had three choices. It was either to flee to England to join the Allies. You could join the resistance movement, although it wasn't a big resistance movement in 1940 for the first couple of years. Or, as my father did, because Norway has border to Russia. And at the time, he figured that, you know, Europe had the choice between two strong men, Hitler or Stalin. And he came from, he and my grandparents, they had just arrived back in Norway after having lived in Brooklyn, New York for many years. They came with a strong anti-communist attitude. And so my father joined the Germans to fight the Russians on the border or just outside Leningrad. So he was in the trenches there for during the war, got injured. And when I grew up, the stories that my father told me from the trenches, they became the backbone for the novel The Redbreast, which is about young Norwegian men making different choices.
Martin Scorsese has signed on to produce or direct The Snowman. What is that like for you?
Well, I'm a big Martin Scorsese fan, so having him involved in that project is, of course, just amazing. I mean, as a student, I had the poster of Taxi Driver over my bed, so that's just amazing.
Are you still in the band?
I am. We don't record any longer. We are still playing gigs during summer, just festivals, you know, few enough gigs so that we stay friends. We may record a couple of songs next year. We are talking about that, but by now it's just for fun. We used to do this full time, but now it's just for fun.
And are you still the songwriter?
I am. You know, the rest of the guys, they are just useless as songwriters. So it's they leave it up to me.
All right. Tell us about the Harry Hole Foundation.
That was a foundation that I decided I was, this was back, yeah, 3-4 years ago. I received a banknote in my, in the post, you know, that told me how much money I had. And I figured it was a bit too much. So I figured that it's probably time to pay back. And through my travels, I learned that probably the one thing that was most important for other countries in third world countries to get to the standard of living to get to the level where the rest of the, at least Western world is, they need to develop democracies. And in order to do that, they need to be able to read and write, to orientate themselves about, you know, candidates and what world is all about. So the foundation is giving money to or fighting illiteracy in third world countries.
What's your next project?
Right now, I'm writing a standalone thriller called The Sun that'll probably and hopefully be published in 2014.
Readers, Phantom is one fabulous page-turning book. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Okay. And now let's hear a sampling of Phantom, performed by Robin Sachs.
Tor Schultz barely heard the plane thundering overhead as he sat on the sofa, breathing heavily. Perspiration lay in a thin layer on his naked upper body, and the echoes of iron on iron still hung between the bare sitting room walls. Behind him were his weights and the mock leather upholstered bench, glistening with his sweat. From the TV screen, Don Draper peered through his own cigarette smoke, sipping whiskey from a glass. Another plane roared over the rooftops. Mad Men. The 60s. USA. Women wearing decent clothes. Decent drinks in decent glasses. Decent cigarettes without menthol and filters. The days when what didn't kill you made you stronger. He had bought only the first season, watched it again and again. He wasn't sure he would like the next season. Tor Schultz looked at the white line on the glass coffee table and dried the edge of his ID card. He had used his card to chop it up, as usual. The card that he attached to the pocket of his captain's uniform, the card that gave him access to the cockpit, the sky, the salary. The card that made him what he was. The card that, with everything else, would be taken from him if he was found out. That was why it felt right to use the ID card. There was, in all the dishonesty, something honest about it. They were going back to Bangkok early tomorrow morning. 2 rest days at the Sukhumvit residence. Good. It would be good now. Better than before. He hadn't liked the arrangement when he flew from Amsterdam. Too much risk. After it had been discovered how deeply involved the South American crews were in cocaine smuggling to the Schiphol airport, all crews, regardless of airline, risked having their hand luggage checked and being subjected to a body search. Furthermore, the arrangement had been that on landing he would carry the packages and keep them in his bag until later in the day, when he flew an internal flight to Bergen, Trondheim or Stavanger. Internal flights that he had to make, even if it meant he was forced to absorb delays from Amsterdam by burning up extra fuel. At Gardermoen, he was on the air side all the time, of course, so there was no customs check. But occasionally he had to store the drugs in his bag for 16 hours before he could deliver them. And deliveries had not always been without risk either. Public parking lots, restaurants with far too few customers, hotels with observant receptionists. He rolled up a 1,000-kroner note he'd taken from an envelope he'd been given the last time he was here. There were specially designed plastic tubes for the purpose, but he was not that kind. He was not the heavy user she had told her divorce lawyer he was. The sly maintained she wanted a divorce because she did not wish to see her children growing up with a drug addict father, and she had no interest in watching him snort away their house and home. And it had nothing to do with flight attendants. She couldn't give a damn, had stopped worrying about that years ago. His age would take care of that. She and the lawyer had given him an ultimatum. She would take over the house, the children, and the remnants of the inheritance he hadn't squandered, or they would report him for possession and use of cocaine. She had gathered together enough evidence for even his own lawyer to say that he would be convicted and dumped by his airline. It had been a simple choice. All she had allowed him to retain were the debts. He got to his feet and went to the window and stared out. Surely they would be here soon, wouldn't they? This was quite a new arrangement. He was to take a package on an outward flight to Bangkok. God knows why. Fish to Lofoten, as they said in Norwegian, and so on. Anyway, this was the sixth trip, and so far everything had gone without a hitch. There were lights in the neighbouring houses, but they were so far apart. Lonely habitations, he thought.
That was Phantom by Joe Nesbo. Been dreaming of a new kitchen? One right for the way you cook and your space? Lifestyles Kitchens is one of New England's top design studios. Our designers come to your home, assess your space, understand your budget, and design the perfect kitchen or bath with you. Your dream kitchen doesn't come out of a box or a big box store. Contact us today at lifestyleskitchens.com. That's two S's, lifestyleskitchens.com. Win marks CJ Box's 11th installment of the popular Joe Pickett series. At first, the story seems one of small-town thinking with petty local politics set against the wide expanse of Wyoming's emptiness. But with the arrival of wind turbines, unlikely new players take center stage. When Earl Alden is found dead, dangling from a wind turbine, his wife Missy is arrested. Unfortunately for Game Warden Joe Pickett, Missy is his not-so-beloved mother-in-law. Early signs point to her guilt, but things start to happen that make Joe wonder. Is Earl's death what it appears to be? Is Missy being set up? With the county DA and sheriff on the one side and his wife on the other, Joe must find the truth. David Chandler narrates.
He threaded his horse up through gnarled, bell-shaped stands of juniper. The trees were heavy with clusters of green buds, and the scent within the stand was sweet and heavy, and it reminded him of a gin martini. His horse spooked rabbits that shot out from bunches of tall grass like squeezed grapefruit seeds, and he pushed a small herd of mule deer out ahead of him. It had warmed to the mid-70s, and as the temperature rose, so did the insect hum from the ankle-high grass. He hummed, too, along with the theme from The Big Country. He tried to remember the movie itself, Gregory Peck or William Holden, but that was beyond his recollection. He made a note to himself to ask Jose Maria to order it from Netflix. He paused the iPod and stuffed the earbuds and cord into his breast pocket as he urged his horse up the gentle slope. The thrumming of insects gave way to the watery sound of wind in the tops of the trees. The transition from an earth sound to the sounds of the sky thrilled him every time, but not nearly as much as what he knew he'd see when he crested the hill. Clamping his Stetson tight on his head with his free right hand as he cleared the timber, the old man urged his horse to step lively to the top. Now the only sound was the full-throated Class 5 wind, but there was something folded inside it, almost on another auditory level, that was high-pitched, rhythmic, and purposeful. He had once heard Jose Maria describe the sound as similar to a mallard drake in flight along the surface of a river, a furious beating of wings punctuated by a high-pitched but breathy squeak, squeak, squeak that meant the bird was getting closer. From the crown of the hill, he looked down at the sagebrush prairie that stretched out as far as his eyes could see until it bumped up against the Bighorn Mountains of Wyoming. And it was all his. From the gray and gold of the prairie floor, across 5,000 acres on a high ridge, sprung 100 wind turbines in various stages of construction, where just a year ago there had been nothing but wind-sculpted rock poking out of the surface like dry land coral. A fresh network of straight-line dirt roads connected them all. The finished turbines, and there were only 10 of them operational, climbed 250 feet into the sky. He loved the fact that each tower was 100 feet higher than the Statue of Liberty. And they were lined up tall and white and perfect in a straight line along the hump-backed spine of a ridge in the basin. All 10 working turbines had blades attached. The blades spun, slicing through the Wyoming sky, making that unique whistling sound that was the sound of money.
We've just heard Cold Wind by C.J. Box. Gone Girl was one of last year's top titles, but contrary to what you may think, it was not Gillian Flynn's first novel. The Book Report believes you might want more from the author who Stephen King calls the real deal, a sharp, acerbic, and compelling storyteller with a knack for the macabre. In Dark Places, Libby Day was 7 when her mother and 2 sisters were murdered in the Satan sacrifice of Kankakee, Kansas. As her family lay dying, little Libby fled their tiny farmhouse into the freezing January snow. She survived and famously testified that her 15-year-old brother, Ben, was the killer. 25 years later, Ben sits in prison, and troubled Libby lives off the dregs of a trust fund created by well-wishers who've long forgotten her. When the Kill Club, a macabre secret society obsessed with notorious crimes, locates Libby, they press her to reopen the case. They're looking for proof that might free Ben. Libby hatches a plan to profit from her tragic history. For a fee, she'll reconnect with the players from that night and report her findings to the club. And maybe she'll admit her testimony wasn't so solid after all. Piece by piece, the unimaginable truth emerges, and Libby finds herself right back where she started, on the run from a killer. An ensemble cast performs the work.
When I was still a kid, the donations were placed in a conservatively managed bank account, which, back in the day, saw a jump about every 3 to 4 years, when some magazine or news station ran an update on me. Little Libby's brand new day. The lone survivor of the Prairie Massacre turns a bittersweet 10. Me in scruffy pigtails on the possum lawn outside my Aunt Diane's trailer. Diane's thick tree calves exposed by a rare skirt planted in the yellow grass behind me. Brave baby days, sweet 16. Me, still miniature, my face aglow with birthday candles, my shirt too tight over breasts that had gone D-cup that year, comic book-sized on my tiny frame, ridiculous, porny. I'd lived off that cash for more than 13 years, but it was almost gone. I had a meeting that afternoon to determine exactly how gone. Once a year, the man who managed the money, an unblinking, pink-cheeked banker named Jim Jeffries, insisted on taking me to lunch. A checkup, he called it. We'd eat something in the $20 range and talk about my life. He'd known me since I was this high, after all. As for me, I knew almost nothing about Jim Jeffries and never asked, viewing the appointments always from the same kid's eye view. Be polite, but barely, and get it over with. Single-word answers, tired sighs. The one thing I suspected about Jim Jeffries was that he must be Christian, churchy. He had the patience and optimism of someone who thought Jesus was watching. I wasn't due for a checkup for another 8 or 9 months, but Jim Jeffries had nagged, leaving phone messages in a serious, hushed voice, saying he'd done all he could to extend the life of the fund, but it was time to think about next steps. And here again came the meanness. I immediately thought about that other little tabloid girl, Jamie something, who'd lost her family the same year, 1985. She'd had part of her face burned off in a fire her dad set that killed everyone else in her family.
That was Dark Places by Gillian Flynn. In the old days, the mystery cliché was the butler did it. These days, there's no butlers and lots of great contributors to the genre. The mystery scene has never been so vibrant. Hopefully, we've given you some great clues today as to which titles to pick up next. For more suggestions, check my website, bookreportradio.com. Thanks so much for journeying along with us today, and let's do it again next week on The Book Report.